It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll continue our Hidden Wisconsin series where we speak with people around the state about what their jobs are like behind the scenes.
Today, we'll be speaking with family physicians about what it's like to deliver babies. But before we get to that, today is the first day that same-sex couples can get married in Minnesota.
This is drawing some Wisconsinites across the border. WPR reporter Maureen McCollum is in Minnesota today with a Wisconsinite couple getting married, and she joins us by phone. Maureen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob.
Now, you're going to be witnessing a wedding today. Who's getting married?
I am. It's a couple from Fountain City, Wisconsin. They've been together for, I believe, 15 years, if not longer. And they've actually talked about moving to La Crosse. And now they're talking about moving to Minnesota since they're going to be getting married in Minnesota. One of the women is the president of the LGBT Center in La Crosse. And they're both professors. They both have successful careers and are very, very excited about today.
Is their marriage going to be recognized back on this side of the border?
No. In Wisconsin, under law, same-sex marriages are not permitted and they're not recognized. So what it'll mean for them, if they do continue living in Wisconsin, is that they will be able to receive federal benefits. And with DOMA being overturned, you know, all those details are still being worked out. But essentially, they won't be able to get the state benefits in Wisconsin, but they can get the federal benefits. And I believe they're registered as a domestic partnership, so they can continue receiving the domestic partnership benefits, even though they're still married.
They are not the only ones, right? You've been trying to track down how many Wisconsin couples are filing for a marriage license in Minnesota. What have you found out so far?
It really depends on the county. You know, in the smaller counties, they're able to track it a little better because they're only getting a couple marriage licenses on any given week anyways. So in St. Louis County, which is where Duluth is located, one of the staffers there told me that they've had three Wisconsin couples apply, and that was out of about 37 couples. And they haven't really been differentiating between genders. And that's what the larger counties will say, too. When I called the counties in the Twin Cities area, they say, you know, because marriage license applications no longer state gender on there, they're not really tracking. I'm sure eventually they will, maybe once this week kind of goes through. But it is a little scattered. And, you know, some of the smaller counties, more rural counties in Minnesota along the border of Wisconsin, they have seen like one or two couples. So, you know, people, of course, are excited because this is the first day. But I also talked with a county recorder, which that's the Minnesota version of a county clerk. And, you know, they've heard of couples, too, some same-sex couples who just want to take their time and plan out their wedding. And when they're ready, they'll get married.
And they're changing the marriage license and the licensing process, right? You mentioned it doesn't say bride or groom anymore. What are they doing?
Now, instead of listing bride and groom, it'll say applicant one and applicant two. And there's some other language in the application, too, that just refers to couples. So it just eliminates all gender-biased terminology.
And talking to the couple you're following today, you mentioned the possibility that they're considering moving to Minnesota. Did I get that right?
Correct. Yeah, they are thinking about moving to La Crescent, which is a Minnesota town just across the river from La Crosse. And I'm not really sure where they're at with that. Now I'll find out, you know, once we talk after their wedding. But when the legislators passed gay marriage this spring, I was talking with a handful of people from La Crosse, just, you know, about their reaction to it. And immediately lots of couples were like, oh, we're moving to Minnesota. Now, last time I talked to this couple, the one who's getting married today, they said that excitement's kind of died down. They're still considering, and they've heard of just one other couple who's thinking about moving. But, you know, that's just the La Crosse area. We, you know, share fourth of our state with the border of Minnesota, so there could be couples all over Minnesota or all over Wisconsin thinking about moving to Minnesota.
As you're following this story in the future, are you thinking there are going to be a lot of weird legal wrinkles to iron out?
I think so. one very interesting law that's actually still on the books in Wisconsin is this law that penalizes Wisconsin couples from entering, quote, prohibited marriages. And when I've talked to people, they said that this was a law introduced like 100 years ago, and basically it was trying to cut down on the number of young girls running off to marry older men. And it's a felony. It carries, you could spend 90 days in jail or face a $10,000 maximum fine. Now, nobody knows of anyone, at least in recent years, that's been penalized for going to Iowa or Minnesota to get married. But when I talked to the lawyer yesterday, he said it's still risky, and it's something that probably should be addressed.
We'll keep an eye on that. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thanks, Rob.
That's Maureen McCollum, WPR reporter in La Crosse.
Now we'll check headlines, and then it's our Hidden Wisconsin series where we go behind the scenes, this time with a couple of doctors who deliver babies, hundreds of them between the two of them. That's coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time for the second installment of Hidden Wisconsin Now, where we get the inside scoop on the work lives of people who we may cross paths with but really know nothing about what their jobs are like.
We've gotten lots of great tips from you, from state bee inspector to sanitation worker. We're going to follow up on those for future shows.
Right now, though, we're going behind the scenes with Jency Carlson and Jamie Conniff. They're both practitioners in the University of Wisconsin Department of Family Medicine, and we're talking to them today about what it's like to deliver babies. Jency, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Jamie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Jency, let's start with you. As a family physician, you see women from conception through birth. What is it like to be involved in the process of birth?
It's amazing. And it's amazing every time I get to go through it. And the best part is, as a family doctor, we really get to take care of people from birth to death. So a lot of the women who I take care of, I took care of them before they got pregnant, talked to them about getting pregnant, took care of them through their pregnancy. And then once they have their baby, I get to see their baby and take care of those babies. I don't know, the oldest one I've delivered now is about 3.
Oh. So how many babies have you delivered?
I've delivered about 150.
Whoa.
Which is a really small number compared to some of my partners who've been practicing for years longer.
Jamie, how many have you delivered?
I think not quite that many, maybe 120 or 130.
That's amazing. I don't know. So this is in Wisconsin, jobs we don't know about. But I will say when I had my 2 children, I became really fascinated with the process of birth. And I for a while thought that I wanted to be involved somehow in it. What is it like as you two, you actually do this job? I mean, it felt like a miracle to me. Does it feel like a miracle to you, Jamie?
It does. I mean, it does feel kind of like a miracle every time. You know, I think when I first started delivering babies, I assumed that at some point it would get old, that, you know, the emotions of the delivery would start being less with future deliveries. And it kind of surprisingly, it really hasn't happened. And that's one of the really nice things about being involved in births is that there are emotions, and it really does feel like a miracle, which is something that, you know, doesn't happen as much in other areas of medicine.
What about you, Jency? How would you describe the feeling?
I think it's absolutely amazing. I remember the first time I delivered a baby and thinking to myself, there's absolutely no way that's going to fit. And I think it continues to amaze me each time. And it's just amazing to get to see people's families grow and parents' reactions to their new babies. And to get to be a part of that, I get pretty emotional with every delivery. And I think if that ever went away, it might be my time to be done delivering babies.
Do you deliver all of the babies of your patients? Not all doctors do this.
Yeah. So and that's really what we get to do as family doctors, as opposed to OBs, is that we typically follow our patients all the way through pregnancy and then come to the delivery. So we're the doctors who actually get woken up at 2 a.m. when we're not expecting it and run to the hospital to deliver a baby.
So you really see it all the way through.
Yeah.
Is there ever a time where you're in the middle of an episode of The Wire or something and it's 2 a.m. and you're eating popcorn and you think, oh, my gosh? Or do you just always get excited about heading out the door?
It hasn't yet where I've been disappointed. Sometimes the timing's not ideal, but it's usually just so exciting because you've gotten to see this pregnancy grow from the beginning. And so I get really excited to go to the hospital and meet my patients there.
Jamie, do you second that?
I second that, yeah. The feeling of inconvenience lasts for about 5 seconds. The feeling, like the emotional rush and that connection with the patient and the family lasts for obviously years. So it's totally worth it, being, you know, having that episode of The Wire interrupted.
So, Jamie, could you walk us through what happens from your point of view as a physician at a birth?
Sure. You know, I feel like I should probably first say that, you know, I feel like, you know, especially after delivering a baby or, you know, handing the baby up to give to the mother after it's been delivered, you know, there's a lot of thanks and credit that goes to me, which is really totally not appropriate. I've done so little in that process. It's really, obviously, the mother delivers the baby. And so, but, you know, I do have a role there, and that role is mostly to help the baby come out, guide the baby out, you know, with the least amount of damage to the baby and to the mom. So, you know, I'm very careful not to drop the baby. Rule number one is don't drop the baby.
They're awfully slippery when they come out.
I can imagine.
They are awfully slippery.
Have you, I don't know if I should ask you this, but have you ever dropped a baby?
I've never dropped a baby.
Good for you.
There's only lore about it. I don't think we know anyone
Nobody
who's
really
done it.
Drops babies.
Right, I've heard about babies being dropped, but I've never heard a name attached to those stories.
Maybe because they're not in medicine anymore. Okay, so, yeah, what is that moment like, you know, when the baby is crowning?
Right, so, yep, crowning is the term for when the baby's head is really almost out. So, you know, sometimes you can see the baby's head for a while, up to half an hour before the baby actually crowns. But when the baby crowns, so the baby's head is almost out, just the mechanics of it, and so yeah, I guess this will get a little bit graphic. Different doctors do this differently, but in general, you know, one hand, in my case, because, well, it's the way that I do it, my left hand is kind of supporting the mother's tissue. So my hand is kind of supporting the tissue between the vagina and the anus, which is called the perineum. And then the other hand is controlling the baby's head as it comes out. And the goal is to have the baby come out, but not have the baby come out too quickly, because if there's too much force behind the baby or it comes out too quickly, then that can cause more damage. So basically, you know, the first, obviously the head comes out first, and so you can control the delivery of the head and help it come out slowly. And then the shoulders come out next, and the shoulders are the broadest part of the baby. So that's where you can run into trouble if they're too broad. Most of the time they're not, and so basically you kind of help the anterior shoulder, and when I say anterior, that's in terms of the mom, so the baby's anterior shoulder has to fit underneath the pubic bone. You kind of help, you put some downward pressure on the baby to help the anterior shoulder come out. Then you put opposite pressure to help the posterior shoulder come out without causing any, you know, too much damage to the mom. And then the rest of the baby kind of comes out on its own. And that's when not dropping the baby part gets really important.
And I know for parents who don't find out the gender, this is a big moment. This is the moment, right? What is that moment like, Gen Z, where they get to know whether they had a boy or a girl?
I frequently like to put a partner or a parent or whoever the mom support person is in charge of delivering that news. And it doesn't matter what the gender of the baby is. Everyone is excited. So it's a fun moment.
I want to ask you, you must have stories. Not every birth is the same. In fact, every birth, I'm guessing, is different. Do you have any stories you could share with us that stick with you, Gen Z?
One of the stories that sticks with me is kind of my crowning jewel as a physician. I took care of a woman during her pregnancy, and during her pregnancy, she asked about my first name, which was pretty unique. And so I told her a little bit about the history, and she said, "Oh, I really like that name. I really like that name." And then when it came time to deliver her baby, and she had a baby girl, which was a surprise, they decided to name their baby. I like to say not after me, but they liked the name. They didn't dislike me. And so every time I see that baby in clinic, I always, you know, tell her that she's brilliant and funny, and she's going to live up to the name. So.
She's just like you, her namesake. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's an honor, baby,
yes.
Kind of named after you. Yeah. What about you, Jamie?
Sure. The story that has stuck with me the most, at least so far, is actually a story about something going wrong or almost going wrong. So I am still a resident. I'm a third-year resident. And so when I deliver babies, I still have attendings, supervising doctors who are in the rooms with me, just kind of watching the process and making sure that things go smoothly. And so earlier this year, I was delivering a baby, and the attending warned me before the delivery started that she had just recently started feeling a little ill. And so, sure enough, during the delivery, she passed out.
Oh, my.
And so was lying on the floor of the hospital room during the delivery, which, had been going smoothly up until that moment. But then, sure enough, after the baby's head came out, the shoulders got stuck, which is what we call a shoulder dystocia. And, we run through these drills in our head about how to handle that situation frequently, but it doesn't come up that often. And so here I was, basically alone, not alone because I had a couple of great nurses in the room helping me, and the three of us were trying to figure out, how to deliver this baby without a supervising doctor telling us how to do it. And fortunately, we kind of went through a couple of different maneuvers, and it didn't take very long to get the baby's shoulders out. And everything went smoothly, and there was a beautiful baby girl at the end of it. And I think that, thankfully the mom was barely aware that we were having any difficulties. But, I think I probably shook for a good, 24 hours after that.
Wow. Oh, boy. Now that is not exactly what a birth should, what you expect your birth to be like with one of the doctors passing out. Usually you think it's the partner who's there in the room who's going to do the passing out.
Yeah, right.
Well, I hope the physician was okay. So, obviously these are emotional stories. Do you ever, we think of the parents crying, the mother certainly, the father, the partner. Do you guys ever cry?
I cry pretty much every time a partner cries. I am a total sympathetic crier. I do keep it to myself pretty successfully, but I just cannot avoid it.
I same for me, and I tear up. The better I know the family, the more I tear up, and yeah, it's an emotional moment.
Oh boy. Well, speaking, as a patient, I would be fine with my doctor crying, just so you guys know. I think it's nice to know that everyone's in it together and it all feels like a group effort, which it is. Yeah. Do you have a favorite part of your job, Jency?
I think my favorite part that I come back to in all aspects of my job is the relationships that I get to have with people. I really care about my patients, but also they bring so much joy into my life. So I hope that I can share that in their lives as well. But those relationships make it all worth it.
And how about you, Jamie?
Yeah, I think the same thing, relationships. And I really find rewarding providing care at transitions in life. And so what I really value as a family doctor is being able to be there both at the beginning of life, as someone who delivers babies, but then also at the end of life as, someone who, works with hospice and helps, helps my patients have end of life discussions and make those decisions. And sometimes doing both of those things, delivering a baby and having an end of life discussion within a 24-hour period is just something that I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be involved in.
Do you think that it changes the way, Jamie, that you live your life? Because you do get to be present for births and deaths.
It does, absolutely. My life is a pretty mundane one, and I don't have any babies in my own life, and I don't have that many deaths, fortunately, and so being able to be involved in those events in other people's lives really, I think, gives me an appreciation for my life, even for the mundanity of it that I wouldn't necessarily have otherwise.
Sound about right, Jency?
Yeah, that definitely sounds about right. It's such a privilege to get to be present at all of those times in life, and really a privilege that not a lot of people get. So it definitely enriches and broadens my life as well.
Well, I want to thank you both for sharing that experience. We all know a little bit more about this today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
I'm talking with Jency Carlson and Jamie Conniff of the University of Wisconsin Department of Family Medicine.
And that's it for today's Hidden Wisconsin segment, where we look behind the scenes at the work done by the people we rely on around the state.
And remember, we would love to hear your vote for our next Hidden Wisconsin segment. You can tell us what job you'd like to know more about, maybe an unsung job that we interface with every day, but we really don't know what happens there behind the scenes. Give us your vote. You can get in touch on our Facebook page, or you can send an email to centraltime@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Maybe you can volunteer yourself for a future segment, too, at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk with the author of a new cookbook who says it's time we start thinking seriously about using bugs as food. And he's got lots of recipes to help us along the way.
Bug recipes.
Bug recipes.
And we'll look at why the success of Netflix and streaming has changed the entire movie-making game in Hollywood.
Also, singer Steve Earle's in Wisconsin, and we'll chat with him about his music and his time on the hit TV show The Wire.
And we'll keep on top of the news of the day. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a new law in China requiring adult children to care for patients over 60 years old. Do we need a law like that here? We'll ponder that coming up in a few minutes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A new law in China mandates that adult children care for their elderly parents.
It's called the Elderly Rights Law. It says that children have to visit or keep in touch with parents over the age of 60. The children also have to make sure their parents' financial and spiritual needs are met.
Those who don't follow the law could face lawsuits, fines, or even potential jail time.
Well, this got us wondering, should there be something like this in the United States, a requirement that we take care of our elderly parents? What do you think? Let us know at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Barbara McVicker is with us. She's president of Stuck in the Middle. She's a national speaker, author, and an elder care expert. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to get into some of the wider issues of how we take care of our elderly parents in this country. But first, what's your impression of this new law in China?
It's unusual that, as far as I'm concerned, all across the world now, we're going to have to face how are we going to take care of the elderly. China was just the first one to kind of put this into some kind of a law, even though they say it's going to be very hard to enact and that elderly parents can sue their children if their children haven't been taking care of them, but they don't know how they're going to make it work. And I think that that's going to be the problem. Their hope is that just by having this law, it will raise awareness, and hopefully it'll do the same for us in the United States.
Well, do a lot of older children of aging parents feel that their parents are their responsibility? Is that seen as the norm here?
I believe that we've changed so much in terms of culture, in terms of proximity to our parents. Families aren't even made up the same way as they used to be, and so things are very different. Right now, 85% of the care of the elderly is done by family, and it's unpaid. So we have many issues to look at. Number one is, should we in fact find a way to help pay those adult children as they're giving that hands-on care, or as they're making decisions about maybe leaving their jobs in order to move back with mom and dad and take care of them? So we have the same issues that they do in China. How are we going to give our parents good care in the future?
Well, a lot of people are certainly facing this situation right now, dealing with how they're going to care for an elderly parent or parents, maybe while raising children of their own. Mm-hmm. Everybody probably feels like it's a completely unique situation, but how common is it that we're facing this?
That's very common. Families' expectations, no matter what the culture is that they will have some help from their adult children as they grow older. But part of the problem is that those people over 60 maybe haven't prepared as well as they should have for their own retirement and health care. With the longevity of life, with the complications and chronic illnesses that we have now, just health care by itself can bankrupt a family, let alone all the other care that has to go on with the family. Only half of the primary adult children caregivers say that they really wanted to be a primary caregiver, And the other statistic is that only 10% of those kids taking care of mom and dad feel as though the burden is equally distributed among all the siblings.
So, yeah, that's creating new family conflict situations, isn't it? Probably between the parents and their children and among siblings, as you mentioned. How much of a challenge is that?
That's a huge challenge because there's some feeling that maybe it should be the daughter or it should be the person that lives closest to mom and dad. And just because of family histories, maybe that isn't the best person for taking care of mom and dad. Now, one of the things, though, that we do have that China doesn't have is that we have more options for the elderly. We actually have retirement homes and assisted living and things like that. They don't really have that in their culture yet. They will have to implement some kinds of options. We have adult care, we have respite care, we have other different ways to help the family caregiver. But even going forward, we're going to have more as a nation.
We just talked about a Frontline documentary the other day talking about assisted living facilities, for-profit assisted living facilities in particular, raising some concerns, partly about the cost, partly about how we know the quality of care, partly about people with dementia, Alzheimer's and other types of dementia, not getting the care they need. Do we have the right kind of assisted living facilities there for people who aren't quite in nursing home territory?
We have lots of different options as to how good some of those are. You can go online and check and see what kinds of facilities and how they're rated by the state. But yes, we have everything from what's called a CCRC, Continuing Retirement Community, where all the different levels are available, to freestanding, like you said, a nursing home or assisted living. What it's going to look like going forward, I don't know. It could be that we're almost going to divide into two tiers, those people that have private funding and what that kind of care looks like, and then those people that really are on Medicare, Medicaid only, and what will that look like? And that would be a shame if we get to that point.
As individual families, are people having the conversations that they need to have before they're facing this situation among siblings and between parents and children?
I'm kind of laughing as you ask that question because that's my primary mission as I talk all across the country and as I did in my PBS special. We wait for a crisis. That's not the right time to start having these conversations. There's kind of a rule of thumb that when the adult child's 40 and mom and dad are 70, you ought to have those crucial conversations. As far as I'm concerned, it's now because you never know what the future is going to look like. Both the parent needs to get better about being free to talk about these kinds of conversations, end of life, or what happens when you can't live on your own anymore. And the child needs to also make the conversation open and helpful.
How do you get that started? Because this isn't fun stuff to talk about. Nobody wants to think about the day when somebody's is too unhealthy to see to their own needs, dementia coming on, that sort of thing. How do you bring that up in a tactful way that gets the conversation started?
You know, out of love and safety, I think we can bring up any topic. And I think by just saying to mom and dad, I want to be here to help you, and I want to follow your wants, but we have to have open conversations. We also need the 7 essential medical and legal papers signed, and signed sooner than later. I talk about how this is really a 3-generation conversation. I have adult children over the age of 21 that do dumb things like jump out of perfectly functioning airplanes and ski down black slopes. So we really need this to be across all generations. What do you want at end of life? We have to have the papers signed for all 3 generations. So maybe the conversation is, I'm going to my attorney, and I want to make certain that your things are in place and have been updated. Let's go together and make certain we really have a complete understanding here so I can follow your wishes.
I have absolutely no statistics to base this on, but I'm guessing most of us haven't done the things you just said.
You know, 70% of the people in the United States do not even have a will, let alone a power of health care attorney, let alone end-of-life decisions. No, we're not very good as a nation of doing this, but the consequences and the strife and the conflict within families if this isn't done. I've seen so many families standing around a bedside of a parent that is dying, and because there weren't open conversations, those kids never talked to each other again after the death because they were not on the same page.
We've talked some about families not being ready. How about we as a society? We have the baby boomer generation. There's lots of them. They're getting older. Are we as a society ready to deal with them getting older and needing the kind of care we're talking about?
Certainly not. As a society, we're really not talking about it. There's so many other things that make more noise on the national agenda that talking about end of life, talking about how to prepare for retirement, there are so many issues here. Partly, we don't do a good job about talking about end of life. There's not much discussion about hospice and some of the other options. We don't talk about it. We think it's not going to happen. Or more than that is, we think we're all going to die in our sleep when we're healthy.
We're talking to Barbara McVicker about a new law in China mandating adult children visit their elderly parents and take care of them spiritually and financially. That's what prompted this discussion. We're talking about how we take care of seniors in this country.
And we're taking your calls next. Do you think there should be a law about caring for your parents like the one in China that we're not prepared, so maybe the government needs to step in and help us figure out how to do it? Or do we just need more education about what needs to be done to care for elderly parents? Are you taking care of your parents now? What could help? The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can always email us at talk@WPR.org. We'll be continuing this conversation next. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time, and we're picking up with Barbara McVicker now about a law in China that says you have to take care of your elderly parents when they're over 60. If you don't, you could face fines.
And we're talking about what we're doing here to take care of seniors in the United States. We want to hear from you. Are you in this situation? Did you feel like you were prepared or not when you had to help take care of your parents, maybe at the same time as taking care of your kids? Call at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. We'll take a call now from Sherry in Prairie du Sac. Sherry, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I've actually thought about this quite a bit because my parents haven't saved any money. I haven't had to pay anything to take care of them yet, but I'd actually be in favor of something like this if it could be transferred to some other set of parents. I know that sounds funny, but my parents have really done me wrong, and I wouldn't want to spend my money on caring for them, but there's been a lot of other people in my life that I certainly would spend that money on.
Interesting. Thanks for the call, Sherry. So maybe, Barbara, not everybody wants to be responsible for their parents.
There's lots of different reasons that people step in to take care of mom and dad. Sometimes it's out of love. Sometimes it's out of duty. Sometimes it's out of void. And a lot of children have not had a great experience with their parents. And so stepping in and doing some of those intimate caregiving tasks seems like a very odd thing to do. I agree with her that it's tough when you haven't had a good childhood to figure out who's going to take care of mom and dad. Or part of it is, should mom and dad be taking care of themselves?
Thanks a lot for the call, Sherry. We'll go now to Barb in Racine. Barb, hi, you're on the air. Barb, are you there? No, we don't have Barb. You know, one thing I did want to ask about, Barbara, one weird thing, and what you just said jogged it in me, you know, the natural relationship between parent and child is the parent takes care of the child until they're an adult. Is part of the awkwardness and the weirdness of the situation, like all of a sudden what you see as the natural role is completely flipped upside down?
It is. That changing of the hat from one person to the other is very difficult. It's very difficult for the parent. And in fact, I've heard people recently talking about, when did the kids decide that I can't take care of myself anymore? You know, I'm perfectly capable. But on the other hand, the child, the adult child, may be seeing that mom and dad are failing, that there is a safety concern or a health concern. And making that switch is extremely difficult for people on both sides of the coin.
All right, we'll go back to the phones now. We have Jennifer with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. I would just would like to comment that a lot of the law, anyone who's in favor of the law, probably assumes a good relationship between parent-child, and I was cut out for part of when you, so another caller may have touched on that, but if there has been, you know, a battery of the child or sexual assault, molestation and stuff like that, I wonder how that would be handled. And I also wonder about a child with special needs or something, an adult child with Down syndrome, for example, how would that be handled? And then I also think the spiritual care is very difficult to define, and perhaps very making a law to mandate something spiritual seems very un-American to me.
Yeah, that sounds like something that might just happen in China, probably not here. But what do you think about what she had to say, Barbara?
All of those are very difficult situations. And in fact, I've heard a lot of elder law attorneys talking about having to write something into a trust or a will to take care of an adult child who cannot take care of themselves, that has some kind of disability. So the coin goes every which way. There are lots of parents right now, as you were talking about, the boomerang generation coming back in to live with parents. Sometimes grandchildren are in it. A lot of kids that are graduating from college can't get jobs. So who all's taking care of each other is a very strange situation right now. Mom and dad could be taking care of the adult child financially or emotionally or a place for them to live. So families are really going to be stressed going forward of how do we take care of families and how do we as a nation address this problem of how we take care of the elderly with grace and support.
Back to the phones now. Michelle in Duluth is with us. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I have basically been in this position. My mom, who was independent, living in a condo. And to preface this, I didn't have a great relationship with her either. So I kind of came into this out of a sense of duty, like you had said. But in 2009, she was diagnosed with Lewy body dementia, which is not quite Alzheimer's, not quite Parkinson's. And it's pretty fast moving. Since 2009, she's pretty well out of it. So we spent about 5 to 6 weeks in a hospital ward, psychiatric ward, to get her diagnosed, and then went from independent living to the nurse saying she needs to be cared for. So I have a 9-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 14-year-old daughter. My husband's a doctor up here in Duluth, so we have a very busy life in and amongst all of the stress that happened with the diagnosis. So she's actually, we had an end-of-life attorney basically kind of help us through this and how it's going to be financed, because she was on Social Security. All these different things addressed. My mom, unfortunately, will not have the end-of-life conversation. She doesn't believe she's going to die, I guess. I don't know. So we haven't gone that far, but we do have quite a bit of the things that you said in place. And I guess my main comment is an attorney in that capacity has really been helpful for us to kind of guide us to what we needed to do.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Michelle. Barbara, an attorney is important, but not everyone can really afford an attorney, can they?
Well, I think Michelle hit on something very pertinent. And as I said, there are 7 essential medical and legal documents that we all should have no matter what point in life we are. But sometimes the best way to do this is to get a third party to be the one to start the conversation or negotiate it. And you're right, some of those take some hunk of money, whether it's an attorney, whether it's a financial planner, whether it's a, you should be able to get a doctor involved. Hopefully that wouldn't be any added expense. Or some other professional that can kind of start this conversation and push somebody into thinking that it's time to do it. She also stepped in out of duty, which is a very difficult way to take care of mom and dad when there isn't some other strong attachment to mom and dad. There are some free things available. So if go to your local area on aging and start with that phone call, and they can help you find free and available advice.
You mentioned the 7, I think it was legal and medical documents, and actually we had a request on Facebook asking What can you do a quick run through? What are those seven important documents?
The first would be a will. The second is a trust. Now, not everybody, and so when I say seven, it depends upon your life circumstance, whether a trust makes any sense. A power of health care and a power for financial. The health care would be when you can no longer speak for yourself, what kind of individual or trusted person do you want to take over and make those decisions? But along with that goes an end of life. What do you want at end of life? Do you want a DNR or don't you? What kinds of invasive or non-invasive things do you want? So when you look at all seven of those papers, and you can go on my website and get some more information, those are the basis to have all kinds of decisions made by either trusted people when you can't or by legal documents. They need to be signed, though, and updated periodically. None of those things kind of stay in place all the time, particularly if mom or dad move, if life changes and all of a sudden there isn't a spouse. One of the unusual things about some states, and every state is different, that's why I keep saying you need to kind of update these and look at them. In some states, automatically the spouse can step in and be the person, the power of attorney for their other spouse. In some states, that isn't true. You have to designate who that person is that's going to make the decisions for you. So it's fairly complicated, and state by state it's different.
Time for one more call. We have Karen with us in Kenosha. Karen, hi.
Hi.
What's your story?
Yeah, one of the points that I was thinking about, I've had this experience, gone through all this. My mother died in December. She had all of the proper forms and that type of thing. We were lucky. She had her mind up until the end. But there were nine of us, and all of us felt that, of course, we would care for our parents because we loved them. However, the finances would have been almost impossible for when she needed to have assisted living. She was on dialysis. She had a lot of medical things. So I was very grateful for both Medicare and Medicaid. And also, I live in Kenosha County, although I'm Pleasant Prairie, Kenosha County. We have programs available here, as your guest was talking about, calling the aging. They helped us through everything. We had help at home when we needed that, when she didn't necessarily need assisted living but needed somebody with her. They were great about all of the things that they supplied, and we had hospice at the end. And we would never have been able to afford all of that. So I think sometimes if you can't afford to do that part of the care for your parents, you're still responsible. And my parents were loving. I came from, you know, a decent home. Just to see that they're cared for, to see
gotcha.
That they're well.
Thanks a lot, Karen. I'm going to cut in there. Barbara, it sounds like a good message in our last 30 seconds or so is look for help out there.
Yes, and there is lots of help. But one of the first things, and in fact, Karen's family sounded very proactive, that they found out what the local resources were, and they implemented them. And I think two of the probably most unutilized is the area on aging, wherever your parents live, and even where you live, and hospice, that those are two very helpful places that can help you get through this decision-making. It's truly overwhelming to be the adult child caregiver.
Barbara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Barbara McVicker, president of Stuck in the Middle. We'll throw a link to her website on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll talk about what summers were like in Wisconsin during Prohibition. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.